listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
The two inspiring and almost symbiotic memoirs that we'll discuss tonight are not for the faint-hearted. Both Charles Blow and Jesmyn Ward are clear-eyed witnesses. Ward tells of what it is like to grow up smart, poor, black, and female in America's Deep South. Blow chronicles what it was like to grow up there as a smart, poor, black, and sexually conflicted male. As they describe the inner turmoil and even the numbness induced by their surroundings, they bring to these memoirs humanity, context, and deep self-awareness. The civil rights era barely touched Charles Blow's Louisiana hometown of Gippsland. The rare intrusions of modernity are shocking when you read about them. When Blow's family learns of an overturned cattle truck on a nearby highway, they rush out, steal an injured cow, and slaughter it. Some children eat clay. In her Mississippi hometown, just a generation later, Jesmyn Ward describes the deaths of five young men, one being her brother, by suicide, two car accidents, a drug overdose, and a shooting. That's a brutal list, she writes, in its immediacy and its relentlessness, and it's a list that silences people. It silenced me for a long time. But in their words, the South also sings to them. Ward writes, "How could I know that this would be my life, yearning to leave the South and doing so again and again, but perpetually called back to home by a love so thick it choked me?" And Charles Blow writes with tenderness about, quote, "little boys with bare feet and scraped knees, scooped crawdads from the red silt bottoms of tiny streams, the same streams that crawled over their banks and into the streets when a thunderstorm came calling." Neither Charles Blow nor Jesmyn Ward, despite the obstacles and despite the betrayals, remained silenced. They unpack the complexities of race relations, sexuality, and poverty by telling their own stories. And these two books, these tales of survival, loss, and rescue, are now an essential part of the American canon. Jesmyn Ward is currently an associate professor of creative writing at Tulane University. She's the author of the novels Where the Line Bleeds and Salvage the Bones, the latter of which won the 2011 National Book Award. And her memoir, Men We Reaped, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Charles M. Blow has been the visual op-ed columnist for the New York Times since 2008, and I'm sure many of you, like me, turned to him to understand the complexities of living in this country and this world. When he was first hired by the New York Times, Blow became the youngest newsroom department head the paper had ever had. He's also a CNN commentator and has appeared on MSNBC, CNN, Al Jazeera, and HBO. And Robin Cost-Lewis, who is our interlocutor tonight, is a provost fellow in poetry and visual studies at USC. She's a Cave Canem Fellow, which is a wonderful consortium of poets, and she received her MFA from NYU and a degree in Sanskrit from Harvard's Divinity School. You never know how that will come in handy tonight. And her book of poems, The Voyage of the Sable Venus, is forthcoming from Knopf. And you can hear Robin read some of her poems next month in a reading with Claudia Rankine, which I highly recommend. So please join me in welcoming Charles Blow, Jesmyn Ward, and Robin Cost-Lewis. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Hi. Welcome to Aloud again. We have so much to celebrate tonight, but before we begin to discuss these very poignant memoirs, I wanted to just take a moment to thank Louise Steinman. In addition to being a prolific writer, Louise has been curating some of the city's most significant cultural events for the past 20 years. So, Louise, I don't know where you went, but thank you so much. I was at dinner discussing with Charles and Jasmine how Los Angeles is the site of multiple migrations, but one of the ones that I'm most curious about or more obsessed with is that when I was born here in Compton in 1964, one out of three African Americans were from Louisiana. One out of three. You could not date your neighbor. They were most likely related. And then the other two and three were like from Mississippi and Arkansas, right? So I say this all to say is welcome from your family to your West Coast family, because, you know, the migrations between Louisiana and Los Angeles or Louisiana and California, as Jessamine talks about in her book, it's a well-traveled path. So really, truly from your family on the West Coast, welcome. Let's begin. Both your books deal with very intense social and historical issues and the personal ramifications of being impacted in heinous ways by history, politics. The Civil War has a spectral presence throughout the book, throughout the South, the Civil Rights Movement. And yet, I feel very celebratory about these two books. So before we begin our conversation, I just want to quickly contextualize my joy about your work. First, they are memoirs located in the South. Just think about it. When was the last time that happened in American letters, right? A memoir located in the South by African-American writers, out in the same year or same years, roughly. So there's much to celebrate. I can't think of it. We were at dinner trying to locate it. I can't really think of it. So there's much to celebrate in the publication of the books individually and together. The third reason, and perhaps the reason I feel most celebratory about your work being out in the world, is that has to do with the searing observations both book makes about gender, violence, trauma, grief, child abuse, and nevertheless desires, tenacity to survive eventually all things. All the books, both the books end with this incredible want of more life, even after so much slaughter and despair. So we'll return to these themes in a bit, but let's begin with discussing how both your books are inhabited by the surprisingly tender narrative voice. You know, you don't expect when people are going to talk about murder, death, child abuse, sexual abuse, poverty, accidents, that what you're going to encounter from the author is tenderness. But both of you use vulnerability and humility as a tool to counteract all the stereotypes and self-destruction. I'm wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about that. You don't come off in your book as Charles Blow, New York Times columnist. You don't come off in your book as this, like, you know, it's just complete tenderness and vulnerability. And I'm just wondering how that served you in your narrative.
That's a difficult question. I really didn't know what I was doing when I set out to write this memoir. And in many ways, the first draft of this failed because it was just a chronicle of events. And so it took me a very long time, working with my friends who are writers and then also working with my editor to, I think, open the narrative up and to realize that was part of what I had to do, right? In order to fulfill that contract with the reader where I assess what happened in the past, offer some sort of judgment and reasoning for what happened in the past. And so I think it was only after I went through that very long process of editing that I was able to find my way to that voice. Mm. But the way that I found my way to that voice, I think, was by really concentrating on the humanity of everyone involved. You know, like, that's something that I couldn't lose sight of. And that's the way that I did it.
Mm. Okay.
Well, I mean, I agree with a lot with what Jasmine is saying about finding the humanity in people. I think that we reduce so often struggle to harshness in all ways, that these are not fully formed, three-dimensional people,
right?
That because you live with sorrow or oppression, that you do not also experience joy and love.
Exactly.
And when you can realize that that is true and you can capture that and convey that, then that the human experience becomes universal and transcends the character that you're writing about, mm-hmm. and becomes any and every one of us, because we all have those valleys and those peaks. And for me, I am writing just a boy to man story, you know, the first memory at three. Vulnerability is inherent,
yeah,
in the story.
Yeah.
You are small, literally and figuratively, mm-hmm. in the story. Mm-hmm. You are subjugated, and you rely on other people to draw the parameters, mm-hmm. to which you can exist, and the degree to which you can go, both physically and spiritually. Mm-hmm. And being able to exist in that boy and have that boy have a voice and to explore the edges of him and the edges of his world must be a vulnerable thing.
Right.
By its very nature.
Right. Yes. And yet, it's atypical. The courage that you guys show on the page in terms of the level of vulnerability and the level of tenderness that you give not only to your own characters, but to the other characters as well, it doesn't happen just every day in a memoir, or let me say, in American Letters, where characters are constructed about African-American people, right? Where these characters are real people with both, you know, characteristics that are admirable and some that are not. The tenderness that you give your uncle, for example, and he's suffering from mental illness that increases over time, right? You don't get so-called crazy black men in American Letters being treated tenderly often.
Right.
So it's incredibly refreshing on every page that there's all these characters that keep showing up, even the ones that are supposedly, you know, not doing right, things like that. But yet they're so loved by both of you in your books. And more importantly, or equally important, you love yourselves.
Right.
Not as a fetish, not as narcissism, not as some kind of self-reflexive device, but you can tell, you can feel, it's in the pages, that you guys have struggled and you're willing to share that struggle with your readers. You talked about a contract with your readers. Can you say more about that, Jasmine?
Well, I think, you know, that part of what that contract infers is that, you know, first of all, that you are telling the truth, right, about your experience and about the experience of the people that you're writing about, and that, two, that you are being as honest, you are being honest, right, in telling that truth. Mm-hmm. For me, like, that's what that those are the most important aspects of that contract. That and the fact that, you know, that as a writer of a memoir, I feel like I have a responsibility to my reader to render the human beings that I'm writing about on the page as completely and make them as complex and yet as real and relatable as I possibly can. And so, you know, those are all the things that are tied up in that contract, mm-hmm. for me. But then it's interesting to talk about love, because I agree with you, right? I think it's true, and like in both of our books, you can tell that, you know, there's definitely a love there that we feel for the place that we're writing about and the people that we're writing about. And so another part, I think, of that contract is that the reader has to trust that love won't, I don't know, warp what you are writing about, yeah. or, you know, make you pull punches or, yeah. You know, I guess sugarcoat things or,
yeah.
So I think it's complicated. I think there are lots of different sort of aspects of that contract.
Yeah.
But I also think that you have to, I mean, I don't think you know your life until you write your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. I didn't know,
yeah.
you know, my concept of what I was and who I was a collection of ephemeral gases of memories.
Yeah.
and the people who occupied my life, I had drawn narrowly as either heroes or demons. And what you find in the exploration of the people that you write about is that they are complicated, that love is a complicated relationship between you and them, even if you have a horrible experience with them, that love will not be told and dictated to, that it will express as it sees fit, and that you can, and that is a very human thing. And so when you find yourself in the writing wanting to care for this person, that is not a distortion of truth, but the expression of truth.
Yeah.
Because now you have actually hit truth, mm-hmm. which is that love transcends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so my last question to you guys was going to be, what did you learn from writing your books? But I'm going to ask it. because you, I mean, true to the memoir form, you take your readers on a journey with you, or you allow your readers to come with you. You invite them in. The door is always open. So you just said a little bit about what you learned, that, you know, love is complicated, haha. But it truly is. We were talking at dinner about how Toni Morrison wrote that when she was writing Beloved, how complicated it was to write about that landscape, and more particularly to write about the trees, when she knew that black bodies had been lynched on those trees. And yet this incredible ability to appreciate the landscape as a site of pleasure and also a site of incredible, heinous trauma. So I'm wondering, and this is balanced so well in your books, I don't know how you pulled it off, but I wonder what you learned as writers writing the books. You know, you talked about love a little bit, like, what did you learn about yourself, about your communities, about your place?
I mean, just from a purely literary perspective, I learned to lower the lens.
What do you mean?
To not fly at 10,000 feet trying to write about a place and about people, but to lower the lens down to just above the dirt, mm-hmm. right? So that you capture all of the detail and all of the humanity mm-hmm. and all of the struggle. And when you get down close enough to the ground, you actually begin to see the people, mm-hmm. and you see the shadows, and you see where they fall and scrape their knees, mm-hmm. and you see it, and you allow readers then to experience the life as if they are in the room and not hovering above the room, and from a literary perspective, it took me a while, drafts to get to say, you know, you're reporting on this rather than writing about this, mm-hmm. and you have to write about it not as a scene, as a phenomena, but as a lived experience.
Yeah, that must have been an interesting transition for you to make from columnist to memoirist.
Yes, I have a little time.
yeah. How about you? What did you learn from writing?
I mean, when I first set out to write this memoir, as I said a little earlier, I think I didn't really understand what was demanded of me, right? Like what I had to do in order to write about this time in my life, mm-hmm. And write about my brother, write about these young men that I knew. And so, of course, I learned that, right, as I, you know, wrote and then revised and revised and revised and revised. Part of what was so difficult about this process for me, especially in revision, right, when I was doing so much of that, you know, that work where you know, where I had to go back into the past as the narrator and assess, you know, my actions and the actions of others, you know, my family members, you know, the young men that I knew. Like, part of the reason that was so difficult was because I mean, I should have been doing all that work in therapy, right?
Wait, this isn't therapy? You know, this is at least $300,000 of therapy. Yes.
I had actually been, you know, I'd been going to therapy and I wasn't doing any of this. And so as I'm writing the book, I'm having, you know, every day I'm having a different revelation about, you know, why I... You know, when I was younger, why things held such significance for me, why I reacted the way my father did, why my father, you know, lived his life the way that he did, why my mother lived her life. I mean, you know, why my brother lived the... I mean, there were so many... Every day that I was working on this book, especially the revision, I mean, there was just something new that would occur to me where I would figure out, wait, so that's why. Now I understand, you know, and all of that was so painful.
Yeah.
That I mean, that's why when people ask me, you know, about the possibility that I would write another memoir, I always tell them, no, I will never do this again. This is it. Yeah. This is the only one that I will ever write because having those, you know, revelations and doing that emotional work was so difficult.
Yeah. The emotional work, how many of you guys have read the books yet? Yeah. The emotional work is very palpable on the page that they're doing as writers, yes? Yeah, so thank you. I mean, you don't get very often to go along on these intensely intimate psychological journeys that is contextualized by these very complex historical frames. Where you do, I mean, I feel like I learned so much from reading both the books, particularly about gender, which is what I want to talk about next. Both books contain very rich threads. There's like 10 books in each book. But one of the dominant themes is gender. You know, critic and scholar Laura Berlant, in speaking about her mother's death, said something very poignant. She said that her mother was either killed by femininity or died by femininity. Right. And I've thought about that a great deal in terms of gender, and I thought about it very much reading your books. Because it seems to me that so much of the suffering, so much of the constraints that your characters experience, so much of what is self-inflicted, so much of what is inflicted upon others, very much spring out of these notions of gender, and in this case, masculinity. People in your books die or are murdered or commit suicide, partly, or they're depressed, right, which is something we should talk about, depression, because they cannot fit within the constraints of masculinity. And I wonder if you can talk about what writing these books taught you about masculinity.
I don't know if the writing taught me about masculinity as much as it allowed me an avenue to discuss masculinity and to talk about the perilously narrow way that we draw masculinity in the collective consciousness and how much kind of heteronormative pressure we put on all boys and men and how much misogyny that they absorb in very casual ways and how dangerous it is because so few will ever be able to reach this level of masculinity. It's like trying to reach the note that's written too high in a song. And you feel your failure. You feel the failure coming on. You feel your failure in the moment. You feel the failure after it has happened because you were never, only a few people were ever meant to hit that note and no one was meant to hold it. Right? And And as we fail to meet this goal, we then hurt ourselves because we feel hurt. Mm-hmm. And we hurt the people around us mm-hmm. because they remind us mm-hmm. that we are not what they thought we could be. Mm-hmm. We are not, you know, be a real man wouldn't do blah, blah. Be a real man. And that real man is an ideal, an unattainable thing, rather than looking at masculinity as an ocean that is shallow in places and deep in others and roiling in places and placid in places, and that it is wide enough and deep enough and complicated enough mm-hmm. and nurturing enough mm-hmm. that all of us can fit as we define ourselves as male.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you. Yes. How about you, Jessamine?
I thought about issues of masculinity before I wrote this book, but there was much that I hadn't, you know, really processed, I think. And it was, you know, in this book, having to write about, especially my father, mm-hmm. and then having to write about my brother, who was the closest of the, you know, of the young men that I write about, mm-hmm. you know, to me. Mm-hmm. I feel like that really taught me, you know, taught me things that I hadn't discovered before I wrote the book. Mm-hmm. You know, especially so when I think about my dad. So there, you know, as I wrote about him and tried to figure out exactly, you know, why he left, why. You know, why he abandoned my family, why he, you know, treated my mother and then us the way that he did. Like, I began to see how the way that he acted, that he wasn't acting out of some vacuum, right? That it really sort of clarified for me this idea that, you know, that history lives in the present. Right, and that it's a very personal thing, right? So I could see the ways that my father was being sort of robbed of any sort of power in the outside world, of any sort of sense of agency. And so because that was the case, he was then sort of asserting himself, you know, and I think grasping a sort of freedom for himself in the only place that he could, which for us was like in the family.
Yes.
And then of course, when I wrote about my brother here, I was thinking about it again, right? Because, you know, whereas it would be a very odd thing for a young woman, you know, in the South from a poor background to, you know, say, I'm gonna sell crack at age 14. For my brother and for his friends,
yeah,
you know, who were young men, like, that was their option, or they thought that was their option. And so that then writing about that then made me think about like what he was perceiving as masculinity, what it meant to be a man, what it meant to be a black man, what it meant to be a black man in the South, and how he was, you know, learning some of these things from my father and what he saw my father going through, mm-hmm. But also, you know, from his friends and from other kids in the, you know, in the neighborhood. So I, you know, personally, I don't know, writing about, you know, my father and my brother, writing about the young men in the book, like that really, you know, it demanded that I look at them with a sort of clear eye, I think, mm-hmm. than I had ever done before.
Yeah. It's ironic because you would think in a patriarchal capitalist society that men would fare well. But in fact, gender is hurting all of us, and it seems, to equal degrees in very complex ways, mostly underground, mostly subconscious or in repressive ways.
But in addition to it hurting everyone, I think that Jasmine's point about intergenerational management of masculinity cannot be overstated.
No.
The fact that older black men grew up in an era where they literally had to suppress masculinity in certain environments, and then that pendulum would swing when they got home because they had to reduce.
Right.
To survive in the outside world and be called a boy when they were twice as old as the man who was calling them a boy, and come home and then say and have to reclaim the mantle of masculinity.
No.
And then have younger men see this. I've seen this. Mm-hmm. And then the pendulum swings the exact opposite direction where they say, I will never suppress any masculine urge. And in fact, I will be hyper expressive, and the dangers that come along with that, and not being able to do, as India Ari sings, bring it back to the middle.
Right. Did he just quote India Ari?
That's my girl.
No, absolutely. The overcompensation transgenerationally, right, of gender, without doubt. I was going to talk about that in a little bit, but we could talk about that now too, right? I mean, the thing that's interesting about both your books, but I think that gets especially played out in your book, Jasmine, is that the way in which your book is blurbed, right, that it's about the death of these four men or four boys. But in fact, when I was reading your book, I was like, well, wait a minute, grandpa, this person, this uncle, I mean, every few pages there is the death of a black man transgenerationally. It just does not stop. Mm-hmm. It does not stop. And to be reading that book in the summertime, this summer, right, when there was so much death, has it ever not been? That's what I finally started to stop being shocked. Has it ever not been so much death of black male bodies and black bodies, period? Mm-hmm. It was especially tender and relevant and all of that. And so I appreciate very much, thank you for that corrective, because though your book is about these four boys that you were close to, it is really about transgenerational black masculinity and how it keeps folding in on itself, the overcompensation, the undercompensation, the nowhere of, you know, where do I fit in when there is no way to make a living? Right, the normative kind of practices of drug selling, right? In my neighborhood where I grew up in LA, they call going to jail a little vacation, the teenagers do right now. You know, he's on a little vacation.
Right? And they call the people who sell the drugs the Flintstones.
Right.
Because they all have cracks and rocks.
Right. It's not funny, but that's funny. Right? I mean, how death and crime and murder and all of this really horrific reality has become normative, that we barely blink, is something that comes across, I think, in your book in the onslaught of so many deaths. Yeah. I also noticed in both your books that seems to be this kind of quiet homage to single motherhood. You guys don't talk, you do talk about it directly, but the book's primary themes are masculinity and boyhood and childhood and growing up and the deaths, both spiritual and physical, of several black bodies. But I was thinking a lot how the women in your books, the majority of whom are single mothers, again, transgenerationally, support the very framework in which these books take place, these narratives take place. Indeed, they're the backdrops of the stories. So Charles's book, which I thought was so beautiful, is dedicated to your mother. And Jasmine, even though your book is about these men, you nevertheless say in one point, it's, quote, harder to be a girl, end quote. And this is after, you know, just horrific amounts of political and social death. So let's discuss for a bit the ways in which your female characters are impacted by gender as well.
Oh.
Either or, jump in.
No, I mean, my mother is, I think, you know, I've heard this my book has not been out that long, but I've heard this quite often, that she is the hero of the book.
Oh, interesting. Oh.
And she's certainly my hero.
Yeah.
You know, she's operating in this world in which what she is doing is completely frowned upon. You know, that having a piece of man is better than having no man at all.
Yeah.
And she just doesn't see it that way.
Yeah.
And she says, I can do bad all by myself, basically. Right. And she leaves my dad with all of us boys.
How many boys were?
There were five of us. One of my brothers stayed with my grandmother. Yeah. And then she moves into the house that my great-grandparents have left, but my great-uncle's still there, but he needs help. He never learned how to read or write, never lived outside of that house. So she, not only is she taking care of all his kids, she's taking care of an elderly man as well. And going to back to school to better herself, which also struck all of the women the wrong way, because it was a sign of a woman who thought too much of herself.
Mm.
Right? And so I would see my mother spurned, not to her face, because she didn't play that, but, but I would see, you know, the way that people would kind of navigate her, or the relatives who would stop coming to visit, or visit my dad, and his sisters would, when my mother wasn't around, would talk down about how this, you know, who does she think she is?
Yeah.
And to watch her in the face of all of that say, I will not be broken.
Right.
As all of these men around me have been broken, was an amazing thing to watch.
Yeah.
And to watch her say, and to demonstrate that education and self-empowerment and self-betterment could have concrete manifestations in a life was transformational for me. To watch her, you know, I never thought she slept. When I was a young kid, I never saw her in a bed. I never saw her bed disturbed. She was awake when I was going to sleep, and she's washing and ironing clothes and making clothes. She bought a few sets of clothes for us, but we didn't have enough money, so she made all of her own clothes.
Oh my God.
So she would be making her clothes, washing and ironing our clothes, because we didn't have enough to stretch for 7 days. And she'd be up in the morning making breakfast by the time I got up. So I literally never thought she slept.
Oh my God.
And she would work all day, and then go to school at night after she got off work, and then come home or make dinner while she's making breakfast, and so we'd have it, or come home and make dinner. And for me to see someone say, I will never be broken, that I can make it, and to know that in addition to all the other things she had stacked against her, she is growing up in a society that leans towards men, was an absolutely amazing thing to watch.
Yeah. Jasmine, how about you? You talked about how your mother kind of said to you or intimated that to be the oldest sister or to be a daughter, this is what it means to be a daughter, not to have desire. Thank you so much for contextualizing that. Not to have desires outside of the home, not to want to be anything. Our job is to take care of the family. And yet you didn't do that. I mean, you did do that for the time in your book, but then eventually we all did. We went off to school. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
It's interesting because my mom, you know, so at the same time that she taught me that, you know, that she's explicitly mm-hmm. said, you know, I need your help. You know, your place is to stay here with me and help me with, you know, your brother and your sisters, and to hold the family together.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, from what, when I was very young, my mother always told me too, that I would go to college and that this was something that was expected for me. I remember her telling me this, I was like 5 years old, and she would say, you're going to go to college, you're going to go to college, which was interesting because, you know, my mother graduated from high school. She took a couple of junior college courses, but she never received a degree. She was, you know, there were seven of them, right, seven kids in my mom's family, and I think maybe only three of them graduated from high school. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of a revolutionary thing for her to say.
Absolutely.
You know, my grandmother had a sixth grade or has a sixth grade education. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was revolutionary for her to tell me from when I was very young, you will go to college. Like that was something that she expected of me. So it's interesting how those two things, you know, how I was given both of those messages at the same time. I mean, I think it's part of the reason why I think I struggled with that when I was younger, right? Because on one hand, you know, there's a section in the book where I talk about, you know, what I looked in the mirror, you know, when I was, say, 12, 13, and I'm beginning to think about, you know, what it means to be a black woman in the South. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, what it means to be a young man in the South. I'm thinking about issues of, you know, gender and sexuality. And so I look at myself in the mirror and the future that I see for myself is probably the same one that my mother looked in the mirror and saw for herself and dreaded, right? Which I think is part of the reason why from when I was very young, she told me that I would go to college because she saw that as the way out, right? The way to avoid, you know, I guess, sort of growing into and becoming, you know, like so many women in my family, you know, what they became, right? I mean, they are, you know, incredibly strong women. Of course, they're human, of course, they're flawed, but still incredibly strong women who, it's the women in my community that hold everything together. Right. They hold the community together. They hold the families together. You know, they are the ones that, you know, that sort of raise the children. And I mean, they're the glue, you know? I joke sometimes and tell people that I feel like, you know, that I came from a matriarchal society. And so, you know, I guess when I looked in the mirror at 12, like I saw, I mean, in some ways it's a beautiful thing, but in some ways it is a burden.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What was your favorite part of the book to write, both of you? What did you just deeply say yes to?
I like the scenes in the beginning. I thought my...
The prologue or the...
No, not the scenes of place.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I thought the places that I grew up in were just magical landscapes. Mm-hmm. And just trying to get people to see those as I had seen them when I saw magic was the fun part.
Yeah. Like,
and I mean, it's, you know, sweet gum trees and honeysuckle bushes.
Yeah.
And
there are lots of trees in both the books.
And high grass and fishing and schools of minnows and clouds of tadpoles. And, you know, to me, it was idyllic in a way. But in my book, there is a constant fight, both literally, naturally, and spiritually, between light and dark, right? Yeah. These are the things that I saw in the daytime.
Right.
And at night, the rules seem to melt away and vanish into the shadows. And everything went haywire. Yeah. And people did things that they would never do under the glare of sun. Mm-hmm. And I was always afraid of what happened in the night. That is when people cross barriers and cross lines that they should never cross.
Right. So that pastoral landscape becomes a night.
It's the daylight. It is the light
yeah.
in my world.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's a great question, and it's the first time someone has ever asked me that question. I think there are two parts for me that I really loved writing. The first was probably the chapter, of course, I don't remember what it's titled right now, but the chapter where, you know, I'm 8 years old and I'm living at my grandmother's house and there are 13 of us living in the house. And maybe the reason that I love that chapter so much is because, you know, when you first tell people that there were 13 of us living in a four-bedroom house, then immediately I think that, you know, that people think, oh, that must have been, you know, awful. And then, you know, and then I go into detail about how we, you know, there was no central heat, there was no central air, there was, you know, we were, it was rough. But it was the one time in my life when I had so many people that I loved living with me, you know, all together. Yeah. My parents were still together at that point. And so I think that that time for me was great to relive on the page. Mm. Because it was so easy for me to recall that love I felt and that sense of belonging. Mm. And just real family that I felt at that time. And then I think the other, you know, chapter of the book that even though it was painful, I loved writing it was probably the last chapter. Yeah. And I think the reason that I feel that way about the last chapter is because, you know, my brother is so present in that chapter, you know, and he's so present, and you know, when I was writing that chapter, it just felt like he was standing right here behind me and sort of looking over my shoulder and telling me all these things, you know, telling me all these things that you know, these memories and, you know, significant, you know, interactions that we had. He was just so present while I was writing that chapter that's a really special part of the book for me.
Thank you. We're getting 50 minutes goes by like that.
Is it?
I'm just getting warmed up. So there's a couple of things I'm just going to try to synopsize so we can get to a few of the concluding questions. One is that just about how obvious that the so-called infrastructure of the South, there is not really any infrastructure. I mean, how crazy it is that Louise and I were talking on the phone that I read your book first and then I read your book second, but in fact, chronologically, his book comes first and then your book comes second. And we were talking about, it's like, there's still people getting killed by the train. Just put a bar, for the love of God. No, seriously. Seriously, like, there's just so many accidents that occur because of the absence of infrastructure. So the books are, of course, as you've heard, meditations on class and poverty. There's so many things that overlap about Black working class. Charles, I think your book takes place before AIDS and crack is formally on the scene in a way that is kind of used and commodified and represented in the press, whereas in your book, it's definitely a presence. The civil rights is there completely in your book. The Civil War as well, yours as well. I mean, your family once owned this land, and then suddenly they don't, because you can guess why, right? All these land grabs that keep happening because of race. There's this recent study, I don't know if you guys saw it, the Casey Foundation just came out with a study that links nationwide failures to nurture Black children to specific social factors. Some from disproportionate exposure to high levels of poverty and violence, barred access to home ownership, to underfunded schools and disparate interaction with the criminal justice system, just to name a few. The list goes on and on and on and on and on. But in so many ways, your books do a much more effective job of magnifying how this infrastructure has, across generations, just, I mean, let's not pretend I was going to say broken down, but let's just go ahead and say it was never there. And so it's in the negative, right? thank you for that, because it's just a very powerful way of using literature to make intimate for the reader the reality of poverty all across the nation, but especially in the South. It would be remiss of me if we were to leave today and I did not talk about child abuse, and more specifically, child sexual abuse. Charles's book is a courageous, elegant, horrific, and redeeming meditation on child sexual abuse. I actually think it's really important. It's important for so many reasons. But one of the reasons why it's really important is, I know you talked about this in your NPR interview, is how often child abuse and child sexual abuse takes place within the home, within the family, unbeknownst to, you know, contrary to what we hear about in the press, right? So that's why Megan's Law in New Jersey came about, right? So we will name the perpetrators who moved in down the block, and I always say, but what about the uncles in the house, right? Like, statistics show that child sexual abuse is primarily, the stats are very high, stacked against a member of the family. So it's a very courageous stance that you take in this book, not only about child sexual abuse, but also then it gets extended towards the end to hazing and fraternities, and it shows, right, how this abuse in terms of gender continues in play and hazing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you want to talk about kind of the idea of I guess what I'm trying to say is, how the hell did you get up the gumption, excuse me, to talk, to be very explicit about the intimate relations of child sexual abuse within families? I mean, it's not fashionable.
Oh, is it not?
And he did it,
My editor should have told me that. Well, I mean, I say, you know, if you don't want to be honest, choose another form, right? Memoir is not for the timid of heart. That's part of my life. That's part of the story, so I have to write it. And but I do think we have some sort of emotional gag reflex to child sexual abuse, to the point where we don't talk about it, even though it is incredibly pervasive.
Yeah.
70% of all sexual assaults in America happen to children, not adults. And we have a concept about who predators are, because we have shows like To Catch a Predator, and it's always a school teacher, 40 years old, and he comes with some Kool-Aid, or I don't know what he comes, you know. But that's not it. It's not Jerry Sandusky, right? If you look at the ages, sexual predators by age, yeah, the age with the most abusers is 14 years old. Mm-hmm. And it goes down from there. 14 also happens to be the age with the most abused kids, but half of all abused kids are 12 and under. And of that cohort, the one age with the most abused children is 4 years old. So very often, rather than talking about a grown man finds a willing victim on Facebook and communicates and shows up at the house, this is another kid in the house,
right?
And we need to figure out how we discuss that, and we need to start having conversations and making safe spaces for all children from the time that we think that they are pre-sexual, because those pre-sexual children are prime targets for sexual abusers. And so we want to put off all of our talk about birds and bees, and we don't understand that these children have already gone through so much, and they have no way of knowing that they are not alone. How could it be me? I have never heard of something like this happening. Mm-hmm. I never hear anybody talk about it, so I must be quiet and not talk about it. And predators search out children who are less likely to speak.
Right.
Social isolation. You know, often kids, you know, it is a known fact that kids who, that people who will eventually identify as LGBT are far more likely to have experienced childhood sexual abuse in their life. One way to think about that, which I completely reject, is that the abuse is making them change their identity. The other way to think about that, which is more likely to be true, is that the childhood sexual abuse is not making you different. The fact that you will eventually be different is making you more likely to be a victim. Mm. And if we turn the conversation in that way, then we realize how much more important it is to protect children who feel isolated, to give them safe spaces and sanctuary in our homes.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I do with my kids is the office, this is your safe space. You can come in here anytime you want, yell and scream and cry and you, whatever. Nothing leaves this room unless you were hurt, you may be hurt, someone else was hurt, or they may be hurt. And those were the only rules. Mm. And there was a lot of yelling at me, there was a lot of tears shed, but it was a safe space. Mm-hmm. And I think we don't create enough safe spaces for children. And they don't feel like they have a voice.
Right. Listening to you talk about statistics, the statistics of child sexual abuse also reminds me of these great feminist slogans from the 80s. Was it every 1 minute, every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes? Can you guys help me who are old enough to remember? Yes. You know, every 1 minute a woman is beaten, every 5 minutes a woman is raped, every 10 minutes a woman, right? And I remember for the... I share your struggles that you discuss in this book very much. I identify with them very much. I remember struggling with those numbers, and I finally came to the conclusion that if sexual abuse, supposedly, which is the going narrative for the longest time, it's very unimaginative, caused queerness, then the whole world would be queer.
Yes.
I mean, let's not pretend.
Yes.
Right? And it's such a heteronormative way of thinking about abuse even, right? So then women perpetrators, thank God for Toni Morrison and Tar Baby, right? Women perpetrators get left off the hook completely, right?
Right, right, because it is a silencing mechanism.
Right.
I mean, I think we can't overstate that enough.
Right.
It is a blame mechanism when you silence a child,
right,
you are saying, if something happens, you have to deal with it.
Right.
Right? Right? Mm-hmm. Which is the cruelest thing.
Right. When they already don't have language.
They already don't have language.
So then it takes 40 years to get to
voice. It takes 40 years and this much therapy.
Right. Jessamyn, sexual abuse comes up in your book too, or, you know, boys behaving badly is a really... Okay. It comes up in Jessamyn's book too. No, but just it's the same thing, that teenage, you know, that age where, and children are not supervised and how scary it can be. Mm. I guess I'll conclude with one sentence. Is that okay, Louise? Okay, now I see where you are. I guess I'll end with asking about your own intellectualism. Both of you guys talk about going away to school, or going to a different kind of school as a way where you began to individuate. And I'm wondering about, you know, both survivor's guilt and how the world opened for you through literature and through exposure. I wonder if you can just conclude saying something about your own experience of your intellectual development.
I have friends, you know, who are writers who say this. And I know that you've probably already heard it before, but I think that it's true. In many ways, books saved my life. And they saved my life because libraries were always really important to me because we were so poor, we never had money to buy books. And so, you know, all my school libraries, elementary through middle school, through high school, and into college, right? I mean, these were important places for me where I was able to, you know, sort of find worlds that were not like my own and realize that, you know, that realize that there were different realities out there, right? And that the life that I was leading and that I saw others around me lead, you know, in my poor Black rural community, like, that wasn't the only life. Right. And so, you know, I mean, it just opened up a sense of possibility for me. And I think strengthened that sense of promise, you know, that my mother started when she said, you're going to go to college.
Yes. Yes.
That's my story.
What she said.
But I'll say it the way James Baldwin said it, which is, you think your pain and your sorrow are unprecedented in the history of the world, and then you read.
That's a really good place to both stop the conversation. It's also a really good, I like that verb, read, because we're going to get to hear still from Jessamine and Charles, just a little brief excerpt from their books. Yeah, so
yes.
Who would like to go first?
We're doing it now?
Oh, we do? Okay. Okay, so yeah, Q&A. Great. There are mics on the floor, everyone.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I really appreciate the conversation, and I've been reading your Jasmine's memoir, and I haven't read your book. I've been reading your columns, and the thing about the what you've raised in your books in terms of the big, really in a very personal ways, some big societal questions, whether it's misogyny, whether it's the journey that you took about why do all these young Black men get killed? And it's, you know, it was your journey, but it opened up, this is systemic. You know, the child abuse, all of these things that you touched on. You know, Robin talked about capitalism. And I guess my question is, where I'm coming from, just my comment is, I think it's systemic. Mm-hmm. I think it's like we have to pull back the camera and say, what kind of a fucking world do we live in? Mm-hmm. That this, and pulling back the camera, not just in this country, but when you talk about the children, and you talk about all these issues, we have to have, I think the conversation is, what kind of a world do people want to live in where we do not live this way? We need a revolution. That's what we need, and we need to talk about that.
Yeah.
A world where this is not the way everything gets decided is not based on what are the needs of humanity, but a handful of people, a system that lives off of exploitation and oppression all around the world. So my question is, in relationship to what you're raising, how your journey looked at that in terms of, you know, when you look at kind of not only why we need one, but in terms of people's response to it and speaking out and being angry about this and saying, this has got to change.
So the question is about why, what now?
I think in some ways that is the sociological question rather than the literary question, right? I think we, on some level, have to separate the two because the author can't solve that conundrum. That said, I believe supremely in the power of stories. All of our histories, our legends, our heroes are captured in stories. Our great religions are books of stories. I think a great story, well told, lives beyond the initial writing of it and can, in fact, with its own strength, change not only the conversation, but the world around the conversation. And I think that the author has to be satisfied if they can reach a level where it becomes that powerful.
Hi, both Charles and Jessamine. First, thank you so much for both of your narratives. I have a couple of questions, and they are specific to Jessamine's, both your memoir and the novel, Salvage the Bones. You're doing something really interesting with Esh in Salvage the Bones. Like, I know that we've talked about how you're discussing masculinity and how masculinity is constructed in certain spaces, particularly sort of rural, black, impoverished areas. But I think something you're doing, you do very well, whether intentionally or not, both in the novel and in the memoir, is talk about how, I am hesitant to say, but femininity or femaleness is constructed. So I'm curious as to what you were thinking or what informed the way that you describe Esh's experiences or sexual encounters in Salvage the Bones. One, when she's like in the back of a truck, but then two, when she's in the bathroom. Both of those scenes could essentially be read as rape scenes in a lot of ways, but I'm very hesitant to read them as such. So I'm curious as to what was going on in your head as the writer when you were constructing that character in those scenes, and what you think it means about black women and sexuality. And then two, I love what you're doing around space, particularly space in the South and the way that black bodies occupy space and how history is sort of wrapped up in that space. And you deal with that so lovely in Salvage the Bones, how disaster strikes, but then also there's still this building of family and history. And that's the foundation of the memoir. So I'm curious as to what really informs your attention to space in that way.
I don't even know if I can answer the second question. I'm going to try to answer the first one. You know, Esh is a girl who is growing up in a world full of men, right? So she, because her mother died when she was very young, and she has three brothers and a father, and all of her brothers have friends, but she's a very lonely, sort of isolated girl. And so, you know, she is sort of casting about in the world around her, trying to find things that will help her figure out what it means to be a woman. And then, spoiler, what it means to be a mother, right? And so she looks in unexpected places to find that, right? She looks to the myths of Greek mythology and Medea, and you know, she looks to this hurricane. She looks to her brother's dog, China, right? And I think that as far as sex is concerned, like I think that. Part of why it's so easy for her to, you know, to have sex and in a way own her sexuality is because she sees it as, this is going to sound awful probably, but she sees it as a way to be seen, right? I mean, she feels so invisible in this world that she's in, and here's this thing that she feels like is easy for her to do, and that in some ways she enjoys, and it's something that she can use in order to, for a second, to feel seen and to be acknowledged as having some sort of power and maybe be loved. And that's how I think that she sees it. As far as, you know, sort of black bodies in space, I mean, I don't know if I can answer that question. I mean, I think it's a very difficult question. I think that, you know, in both books that, you know, one of the things that I'm talking about is the way that, you know, black bodies have been devalued, right, throughout, you know, the history of this country, the history of the South, right, the present day. I mean, there was so much that I saw after Hurricane Katrina that just confirmed that for me, like that black bodies and black lives don't matter. And especially when I was writing Men We Reaped, that's what I was sort of wrestling with. And I mean, you know, to speak briefly on what Charles was saying about like telling stories, I mean, I think that, you know, that's one of the most powerful things that we can do, right, is to speak and to, you know, insist that we be heard, and to, you know, assert our dignity as human beings and to really, I mean, because, I mean, I'm not starting the conversation. I'm just trying to be a part of the conversation. And so.
Or to be used in the conversation.
Yes, yes. And that's, I mean, that's key.
I think we actually are out of time for questions, but I'm sure Jesmyn and Charles will be happy to speak to you at the book signing. I want to thank Robin and Charles and Jesmyn so much, and all of you for being here tonight.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.